Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Twas early in a fine summer's morning as I strolled.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer and this is Murder at Mother Mountain, Deep Dive Number 1. While the story of Ellen's life will continue in part 2 of the main series next week, this episode delves into the history of the period in greater detail. Now, religious records were key to understanding Ellen's early years, and this reflects the importance of religion in general in wider society in the early 19th century in Ireland. However, the Catholic Church, the one that Ellen grew up in, before the famine, was radically different to the organisation that would emerge later in the 19th century. In light of this, I was delighted to get to interview Salvador Ryan. Now, Salvador is the Professor of Ecclesiastical History in Maynooth University, and we chatted about the pre-famine Catholic Church in detail to give you a better understanding into early 19th century life in Ireland. Before beginning, I want to flag that this interview itself is a relic of past times. It was done during COVID and was conducted obviously then online. The call drops out once in the middle of the interview, but it's a minor inconvenience. To begin, Salvador started by giving me an overview of the pre-famine church Ellen grew up in.
If you were to describe the pre-famine Irish church, in many ways, I suppose it was a church that was still functioning almost like it was in the penal times, or certainly the penal times and the fallout from the penal times was very much with it still. So, for instance, in the pre-famine church, it really couldn't provide, I suppose, enough priests or religious for its needs. And the population, of course, was rapidly expanding. So, for instance, if you take it, we'll say between 1750 and 1845, the population of Ireland would have risen from about 2.6 million in 1750 to 8.5 million in 1845. And you don't have to be a mathematician to work out that that would have significant ramifications for pastoral ministry, for instance. The church in Ireland couldn't build enough chapels or churches fast enough to cater for the rising population and the needs of people. And that's coming from, a penal period where many of the chapels had either been taken over or fallen into disuse and so on, and more chapels had to be built. A lack of adequate chapels, I suppose, made it almost impossible for people in some areas to attend Mass. In the 1970s, one academic, David Miller, had famously estimated that Mass attendance in the on the eve of the famine was around 40%. Now, of course, that wasn't right across the board in Ireland. Numbers were higher, for instance, in the eastern half of the country than you'd find them in the south or the southwest and the west. The transformation, I suppose, in the infrastructure of the church from the 18th to the late 19th century was phenomenal. If you take it, for instance, in 1752, there were about 832 simple mass houses in Ireland. Now, I suppose they were little more than thatched sheds, really, with clay floors. Now, contrast that to the late 19th century, where you had at least 24 major cathedrals and more than 3,000 substantial churches, which had been built in the interim. When you look at church personnel, for instance, here's a startling figure for you. In the year 1800, there were only about 122 nuns in Ireland. By 1850, that number had risen to 1,000 nuns. And by 1900, the number stood at around 8,000 nuns. So from 1800, 122 nuns in Ireland, 1900, 8,000. The pre-famine church in Ireland, I suppose, struggled with its priest-to-people ratio. And that's where, I suppose, the onset of the famine changed things very quickly. Now, in precisely, I suppose, those areas where church infrastructure had been at its most difficult, where, for instance, clerical supervision of people had been at its weakest, places like the western and northwestern parts of the country, particularly Irish-speaking parts of the country, there was now an opportunity for clergy to address that imbalance, given the drop in population in those very areas, which was famine-related, obviously. These were also the areas which clung most tightly to traditional religious practice and practices which were increasingly regarded, for instance, as superstitious. James Hall, who was touring through Ireland in 1813, he was in the town of Tralee, and he recalls how he found a respectable-looking man on his knees praying for the repose of the soul of his son. And when the bell tolled, the church bell tolled, the man turned his face towards the church and he prayed more fervently. And James Hall, who was travelling through Ireland, he said he went up to the man and he said to the man that he was glad to see him so devoutly employed. But then he says, though minutely acquainted with the prayers and forms of Catholic worship, I found that he scarcely knew anything either of the doctrines or the duties of Christianity. So in this pre-famine period, you often had, I suppose, a people who were people of prayer rather than a people who were acquainted, we'll say, with the intricacies of Christian doctrine, if you like. Now, by contrast, the same James Hall was going through Carlow, and he met, as he said, he met a tolerably well-dressed, fat-looking farmer who said that he wouldn't give a farthing to have his children taught anything more than the catechism, that all other knowledge was of no use to them whatsoever. So here was a man in 1813, a farmer who obviously thought what the catechism had to tell him was, and what the catechism had to tell his children was very important. The same James Hall was going from Limerick to Killaloe in 1813, and he found a man who couldn't read sitting by the wayside counting his rosary. And when he'd gone through the rosary three times and said his Our Fathers and Hail Marys, he said he told me that he had counted it 15 times every day for many years and trusted in God that nothing had ever happened which would prevent him from performing such important a duty. And we find even in catechisms of the period, just slightly in the famine period itself, in Dublin in 1848, Dunleavy's Irish Catechism, for instance, asked the question, to whom are the beads of greatest use? And it said, it answered, to those who cannot read or those that are not trained up or used to prayer. You would find rosary beads, for instance, even in the poorest of houses, they'd be hanging up on the wall. It was something that it was easy to pray, even for those who weren't able to read religious books of instruction, for instance.
Now, regular mass attendance is something that became central to religious life in Ireland in the later 19th and 20th centuries. As touched on in episode 1, this was not the case for Ellen Kennedy, however. Her home on Keeper Hill was quite far away from the parish church in Newport, so she probably didn't attend Mass on a regular basis. Salvador now explains some of the factors that could influence whether people attended Mass or not.
The American historian Emmett Larkin, who wrote this famous article in 1972 about the devotional revolution, he used figures that he drew from David Miller, which basically said that, roughly speaking, about 40% of people attended Mass on the eve of the famine. And that rose to over 90% by the late 19th century. And Emmett Larkin would say the devotional revolution turned the Irish into what he called practicing Catholics. Now, what he meant by practicing Catholics was church observant Catholics. Now, one Tipperary historian, Tom McGrath, has sort of argued much later that what Larkin was doing was mistaking church life for religious life. Just because people didn't get to Mass didn't necessarily mean that they didn't have a religious or devotional life. So, for instance, there were a lot of reasons why people wouldn't go to Mass or didn't get to Mass. So, for instance, the long distances between their own houses and the church, for instance. You would also get another reason why people stayed away from Mass was not from a lack of devotion, but maybe because of the inappropriate clothing that they had. They didn't have good enough clothing to actually go to Mass. So that's certainly true. I know of one account from Killaloe, for instance, in the 19th century, where two sisters, they attended two separate Masses, and they would actually meet halfway between their house and the church, and they would exchange the one good coat that they had so that the other could go to Mass. There were all sorts of reasons why people didn't go to Mass. And certainly, it wasn't necessarily from a lack of devotion. If you look, I mean, one of the interesting things to look at from this period is the accounts of people who were traveling in Ireland at the time. That's outsiders coming through Ireland, and what their impression of people attending Mass was. So, for instance, Henry Inglis toured Ireland in 1830, and he said when he was in County Kilkenny, he went to Thomastown, and he said it was Sunday morning, Sunday morning in Thomastown, and he said he saw the population of this Kilkenny country parish thronging to the Catholic chapel. He says elsewhere he was traveling between Listowel and Tarbert early one morning, and he said it was Sunday morning, and I observed that the articles of apparel meant to be displayed at Mass and which had been washed the night before had been left on the hedges all night. So again, whatever good clothes that people had, the best clothes that they had was put out on the hedges for the next day. Another writer, George Graham Matheson, visited a chapel in a County Kerry town in 1835. And here's what he described. He said he passed to the chapel. He said it was very dirty and very full. In fact, there was not room for numbers, and the avenue to a great distance and space all around the door was covered with poor creatures. Some were kneeling, some were prostrated as in Eastern climes, some were touching the ground with their faces, others were sitting, others were standing against the wall and begging in the name of God and the Blessed Mother and dealing out blessings on all who passed by. So the impression, at least for some of these travellers through Ireland, is that people thronged the chapels. Now, of course, the chapels oftentimes weren't very big and couldn't hold the number of people who wanted to get in, and they might be out in the yard or around the chapel, not actually being able to get in. So David Miller's statistics aside of 40%, the impression many visitors to Ireland received was of a people who frequented the churches that were actually available to them.
Class background was also a factor that could determine Mass attendance. But as Salvador explains next, in some instances, the priest would travel to remote households.
Yeah, certainly attendance at Mass and the frequency with which people attended Mass was very dependent on your own material circumstances. So if you had the suitable clothing to attend Mass, that meant that you were going to be more inclined to go. Also, your geographical location, where you actually live, how far it was to the Mass. So, for instance, there's an account from 1899 from Ross Muckin in Connemara, where the local priest wrote to his bishop and recounted, you know, how difficult he even found it to travel to say Mass in Camas, which he said was 7 miles away. The road was very hilly and it was very bad, especially in wintertime. So even this was the priest actually getting out to an outlying church. The same difficulties and more faced a lot of families living in remote regions actually getting to a chapel. Of course, the other thing about that, the other thing about being suitably attired as well, it also feeds into this notion of what was appropriate when you actually went to chapel, how you might be dressed, how you might behave when you're in chapel. And it feeds into this increasing emphasis on civility and propriety, certainly in relation to religious observance, and also in relation to how a chapel was decked out, the vestments that a priest would wear, the liturgical vessels that would be used. These often weren't up to scratch, and that's one of the things that something like the Synod of Thurles and these reforming measures put a spotlight on, what was actually appropriate for the fit celebration of the liturgy. So all of these things were bound up together. Of course, I suppose the insufficiency of church structures was offset, I suppose, in a way by the availability of stations in people's houses, the famous stations where mass would be said in the house, and the priest would go to the house, and the neighbors would gather together. And I suppose, despite nearly all the church synods between 1830 and 1875 largely disapproving of them, the practice of the station mass has actually died very hard, if you like. We know from diaries of priests, a diary of a priest from Kilmore Diocese, for instance, covering the years from 1827 to 1829, reveals that he held 60 stations on average each year. And this was also an opportunity for a priest to catechize. So when he would do the station mass, he would gather, would say, children around him, boys and girls, maybe sometimes, in maybe in a barn or whatever, he'd sit in a stool in the middle of the floor and he'd question them on their catechism.
Through Ellen's life, numerous religious services that in later decades would take place in church buildings, such as baptisms and marriages, took place in the family home. I asked Salvador about this.
So, for instance, it was often a case of the priest going to the people rather than the people going to the priest. So if you take, for instance, simple things such as the performance of baptism, or the performance of or the celebration of marriage, for instance. Marriages and baptisms tended for a lot of the 19th century to take place at home. And even church figures recognized that this was absolutely necessary. Some church figures did. Now, obviously, there was the need for reform. The Synod of Thurles and that whole reform movement was trying to relocate these things within their proper church setting, as they would have seen it. But for instance, one bishop, just around the time of the famine, or just slightly after, Bishop Daniel Vaughan of Killaloe, he said that while he was anxious that the sacraments would be administered insofar as possible in the churches, but he was no fool. He said, considering the calamitous circumstances of the times and considering the deplorable condition of the poor people, he said, I will not for the present make it obligatory to have marriages celebrated in the church. So I suppose he was very aware of the realities on the ground. And while all of these instructions might be, and these desiderata, if you like, might be laid out by church synods, such as the Synod of Thurles and so on, that this wasn't always how it would play out on the ground, and it would take a lot of time to put that infrastructure in place. For instance, even in about baptism, in the mid 19th century, when Bishop John O'Sullivan Kinmare attempted to, when John O'Sullivan, Father John O'Sullivan in Kinmare attempted to outlaw baptisms in Kinmare homes, he excited a great storm in consequence, so much so that actually for a long time afterwards, the people refused to bring their children for baptism in the church, because, I mean, baptism at home was the norm. And then in 1835, again, another traveller through Ireland, George Matheson, in his Journal of a Tour in Ireland, he talks about encountering a priest who baptizes in his own house, so that people would go to the priest's house and have their children baptized there. Matheson says, he says the priest baptizes at his own house and in a very slovenly manner. He said, I witnessed one baptism and the whole scene was so much the reverse of all that solemn sacramental rite ought to be. To shuffle over the prayers with railroad celerity seemed to be the priest's sole object. Now, Matheson, you know, Matheson is often critical of the priests and how they administer the sacraments. Having said that, I mean, he says in another place, after he went to hear a priest say Mass in the chapel, and he was very unimpressed by how the priest actually made his way through the liturgy. But then afterwards, he went in to the room, to the side room, to the chapel, and saw the priest on his knees praying fervently for his people. And then his heart, I suppose, changed, because he said, okay, this guy mightn't be the, you know, the most liturgically adept of priests, you know, but his heart is sort of literally in the right place, that he is a man of faith.
Mother Mountain, the title of this series, comes from a very important spiritual site for the communities of Western Tipperary. I wanted to get a better understanding of local celebrations, such as the events to celebrate the Feast of the Assumption at Mother Mountain or Pattern Days that took place in similar locations. In his answer here, Salvador also touches on the subject of holy wells, which featured in episode 1.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, a pattern day. Well, first of all, I mean, pattern days were local celebrations of saints, for instance, the feast days of saints, and celebrated at traditional pilgrimage sites. They're known as patterns because they come from the Irish patron, meaning patron saint. Oftentimes they were conducted around wells, holy wells. We have roughly about 3,000 holy wells, it's estimated, dotted across the country. And these pattern celebrations were dedicated, these holy wells obviously are dedicated to specific saints, and the pattern days were celebrating the feast days of these saints. People would come to these sites, such as holy wells, and they would perform a number of traditional rituals. These would often involve the performance of what are called perambulations. Basically, it's called in Irish a thrust or thuras, going round, doing the rounds, often in one's bare feet, doing the rounds of the well. People would recite the Our Father, the Hail Mary, and Glory Be, and recite these over and over again. They might recite decades of the Rosary. They would mark off the decade sometimes by dropping a pebble after each decade if they didn't have rosary beads. They would then drink from the well itself. They would ask for healing. Holy wells were renowned for the healing of various ailments. So, for instance, the healing of headache or toothache or warts, people who had difficulty walking, loss of sight, and so on. And before pilgrims would leave the site, they would leave behind them a vote of offering. They might leave behind them a ribbon or a strip of cloth or rag, or they might leave a hairpin. They might leave the rosary beads or a holy picture or an item of clothing. These might be hung on a sacred bush or a tree flanking the well. Of course, you can see many of these to this day. these sacred trees with ribbons on them in Holywell sites.
Now, Pattern Days were not quote-unquote official religious celebrations, and I asked Salvador how they fitted into wider Catholic teachings and beliefs.
Practices at Pattern Days didn't always go down well with the church hierarchy. And oftentimes, for various reasons, over time. So, for instance, take one example, one early example. In 1761, Bishop Thomas Burke of Ossory instructed that alms were not to be given to beggars at the site of St. John's Well in Kilkenny, because around the Pattern Days, they turned up in swarms. Many of them pretended to be lame, and this gave rise, as he said, to mobbing, rioting, cursing, swearing, thieving, excessive drinking, and other great debaucheries. Ecclesiastical authorities, church authorities in the 18th and 19th centuries would routinely express grave concerns about people's behavior on such occasions, because once these traditional religious and devotional rituals had finished around midnight, they were often supplanted by, I suppose, what you might call a carnivalesque atmosphere. There would be music, revelry, heavy drinking, sexual licentiousness, and even at times serious violence. But also, it wasn't just the social disorder that church authorities would point to, but they would also be worried about aspects of superstition. So priests would often instruct parishioners not to leave any beads or relics or medals at the well as votive offerings, but to have faith simply in their prayers and to bring the holy water from the well home with them. Again, a traveller to Ireland in 1835, George Matheson, records how a woman went to a local holy well to have her bad eyesight cured, while, he says, her superstition was left unchallenged by the priest, who just shrugged his shoulders when Matheson asked if she would not instead, you know, ask God to bless the doctor's prescription. And Matheson then remarked, because he said, you know, this priest isn't really correcting her as he should. And Matheson says, you know, the old women teach the children and the priests hold their tongues. So you had a variety of responses. So some priests and church members of the church hierarchy would try to instruct people or try to quash some of the more superstitious elements, and others would just throw their hands in the air and say, there's nothing much we can do about this. There's a lovely story, in fact, from the mid-1850s about a mother who wasn't able to read or write, and she asked someone to write a letter for her, and because she wanted to send this letter to her son, and her son was fighting with the British forces in the Crimea. And she enclosed in the letter some stones from a local well for his protection. And she said to put in the letter, she said, tell my son, tell him that if he'll receive them and wear them in this purse around his neck with the same faith that his own mother is sending him, please God that he'll come home back safe and sound. Now the letter writer, interestingly, almost sort of challenged her on this. And the letter writer said to her, he said, I'll bet my life, he says, Father Mick won't let you send the stones nor go to the well at all. To which the woman replied, didn't Father Mick knows I gave rounds at the well for him, and I sent him the lining of the well in a letter, and he didn't say ill you did it to me when I told him. So basically, she was confident that Father Mick, the local church authority in the region, that he would understand what she had done, because hadn't she done the same for him?
Salvador now explains how they went into decline in the years before the famine.
So, for instance, when we're talking about the patterns and, devotions at Holy Well, in many ways, the Pattern Days and the celebration of Pattern Days, a lot of the problems that were being pointed out by the church about those Pattern Days, they were actually almost coming to an end even on the eve of the famine. Even as early as the eve of the famine, the heyday of the Pattern Days had really gone, which is interesting. But one of the things, of course, that we see in more recent times is a revival of interest in visits to Holy Wells, and particularly at a time, of course, when church observance in terms of church attendance figures are obviously plummeting, but you have this revival of interest in holy wells and visiting holy wells and the observance of patterns. It's interesting that in one man who was interviewed in 2015, and he was interviewed about his local pattern day, and he had this, he had the following to say about the continued adherence to rituals surrounding holy wells. So he was asked about, you know, why these continue to be so popular. And this is what he said. He said, well, of course, he says, you know, the wells, he says, go back 10,000 years. The mass only goes back about 2,000. Tis a modern innovation, you know. He says, God forgive me for saying it. He says, a modern innovation. So I think that really captures something, at least about the perception of these holy sites in the landscape. And how far they go back, certainly about people's perception.
The landscape was obviously very important in the pre-famine church. I was really curious about this, and Salvador now explains how some of this was just practical.
You know, in some regions of the country, well into the mid-19th century, in some remote regions of the country, up in the northwest, even, you had people who were still actually going to celebrate Mass at Mass Rocks. And that wasn't because people were being persecuted, or it wasn't even out of a sense of sentimentality towards Mass Rocks and a detachment to Mass Rocks. It was just a very practical thing. That Mass was oftentimes celebrated outdoors, because there simply wasn't a suitable chapel available nearby. And this is all about, again, church infrastructure and the building of chapels. Yes, for a quite considerable length of time, the church infrastructure in Ireland just simply wasn't there, the building's infrastructure. So this became a necessity, and people became used to religious practice outdoors, and not only, you know, at places like Mass Rocks, but also at sacred sites in the landscape. Now, contrast that, I think, with say this push to move everything more into a church setting. So, for instance, in the 1830s, the Catholic Penny Magazine published 12 regulations for conduct in the house of God, and these were to be read by both priests and people. And the emphasis, of course, was on propriety, civility, proper dress, and proper forms of behavior. So among the things that it stated, it said, you know, persons should avoid, if at all possible, coughing, spitting, and all manners of noise within the chapel. People should be remarkably clean in their dress. They should appear in a respectful posture. They should avoid any ridiculous gestures or forms. So by contrast, we'd say this was the world of the chapel, a world of increasing restraint and clerical supervision. At least in principle, it didn't allow the exercise of, we say, pious devotions in a myriad of different ways that you might see at a holy well or around a sacred tree or some other sacred site in the landscape, where it was less supervised, where people were freer in a way to do their own thing. While these gatherings might be criticized by church authorities, there was less clerical supervision than you would have within a chapel setting. So before the proliferation of chapels, I suppose, Irish Catholics made the landscape and its sacred sites part and parcel of religious life and their daily observance. And these sites, I suppose, as we talked about patterns, they blended religious devotion and also entertainment. If you think of things like, you know, wakes and funerals, you know, these pattern days, even celebration of marriages and so on, these occasions had multiple purposes. And they can't so easily be neatly divided into the sacred and the profane. And of course, this continued to a certain extent even after the building of chapels, where chapels were used for all manner of purposes. And in a way, it's interesting because it's a kind of a throwback to how churches were used, for instance, in the Middle Ages, because churches were not just for worship. you had all sorts of things that happened in churches because they were a local building. Churches was were a local building that was there that could house, you know, a number of people, that was dry, that was warm. They are community spaces, if you like. And this use of chapels as community spaces would continue even into the late 19th century. So there is an uneasy transition from sort of religious life in the landscape, and then shifting into a chapel where you're supposed to be a lot more formal and a lot more proper. It doesn't always work that way. These chapels often remain centres of entertainment, tradition, and community building.
To get a better sense of the pre-famine church, I asked Salvador if a famine emigrant had returned, would they notice a difference between the pre- and post-famine Catholic Church?
In terms of the vast changes that occurred in Irish Catholicism from around the middle of the 19th century onwards, this was Emmet Larkin's famous devotional revolution thesis, which has been sort of modified since he originally published it in 1972. So certainly there were vast changes that took place in Irish Catholicism over that period. I think modern historians would, Emmet Larkin put a lot of emphasis on the figure of Archbishop Paul Cullen, and would say the Synod of Thurles in 1850, but the figure of Cullen himself. I think more recent historians are anxious to say, look, it didn't all start with Cullen, that many of the trends that you see in the later 19th century in terms of church reform had already started. We say in places like Dublin under James Murray, Archbishop James Murray, in places like Kildare and Loughlin under Bishop James Dial at a much earlier stage. So these trends were already there, but they were. It's Cullen is given the lion's share of the credit for it. He calls the Synod of Thurles 1850. It'll be the first national synod in Ireland since the 17th century. His vision really was the reappropriation of space, the encouragement of church building to wean people away from domestic religious practice and to reverse the worrying trend of traditional religion outside of church settings beyond the supervision of the clergy. So he would impose stricter clerical discipline. He would promote, for instance, parish missions and retreats. He would promote a wealth of devotions, often described as Roman devotions, but also anglicized devotions, promote the dissemination of popular religious literature, prayer books, the dissemination of sacramentals, such as, rosary beads, such as, Sacred Heart images and all of these sort of things, scapulars and so on, popular prayer books. The Synod rule of Thurles ruled that administration of the sacrament should take place in churches, not private houses. Now, there was some resistance, of course, to this, to outlawing the celebration of sacraments at home. One person who could see this was actually Archbishop Slattery of Cashel, in whose diocese, obviously, the Synod of Thurles took place. He wasn't in favour of the complete banning of this practice. And in fact, Paul Cullen became frustrated with Slattery. He said in one letter, he said he's the only, or almost the only bishop who has done nothing about what was prescribed in the Synod of Thurles. He says, baptisms and confessions remain as they formerly were. They also celebrate marriages in private houses. So in some regions, reform was slow. We've talked about station masses, for instance. Station masses were subject to special scrutiny. There were problems, for instance, the church hierarchy had problems with the hearing of confessions of men and women without the use of a confessional. But of course, that wasn't all, if you're hearing these in people's houses, that's not very practical. The synod was gravely concerned about the hearing of women's confessions in private houses, saying that confessions should be heard in churches and they should be heard in confessionals. And it's interesting, Rome actually requested at one stage that if it was absolutely necessary to hear the confessions of women and men in private houses, that a fairly bulkable or a fairly bulky portable screen should be actually carried, physically carried to these houses. And Colin, Archbishop Colin, was tasked with selling the idea. It didn't go down too well in a lot of locations. I mean, I know the Bishop of Kerry, David Moriarty, when he presented the idea to his priests, he got some choice answers or comments about the prospect of, you know, hauling bulky confessional screens to some of the areas that they had to routinely visit in very remote and rural areas for station masses. There was also a clampdown one of the reasons for the clampdown on private masses in private houses was around abuses associated with the practice, such as clergy seeking large, you know, offerings of money. For instance, they could receive as much as £40 in a single collection. Also, the perception of the clergy and how the clergy actually behaved, the lives and the conduct of priests would come under increasing scrutiny with the Synod of Thurles. For instance, it was said clergy should avoid secular company. They should avoid intemperance, public dances, race meetings, avoid card playing in public theatres. They should preserve their chastity. No parish priest was allowed to hold more than 15 acres, and curates were forbidden to hold any land whatsoever. And I suppose this was to counteract the tendency among many Irish priests to double job as farmers, because they could get a considerable amount of money from double jobbing. And also priests were ordered to wear clerical collars. They were to distinguish themselves from their parishioners. So you almost get this move towards a greater professionalization of the clergy. So these things, you know, these are some of the things that someone coming back would have noticed in terms of a different attitude among the clergy, how the clergy were dressed. Again, these things took time to implement, obviously. And then the proliferation of Catholic material culture. So there are more prayer books, popular prayer books circulated. There are more religious medals, more scapulars. And these things, of course, are often sold at parish missions. The parish mission movement that started in the early 1840s, for instance, was hugely instrumental in changing the face of Irish Catholicism. These parish missions went around nearly every parish in the country. And with them, you had these hawkers outside selling religious goods. Also at parish missions, for instance, you had people maybe receiving the sacraments who hadn't received the sacraments for years, or maybe not at all. So for instance, there's a famous one in Dingle in 1846, where there's a parish mission, a Redemptorist parish mission in Dingle, and so many people thronged to the parish mission to receive the sacrament of confirmation. It was about 1,000 people who thronged to receive confirmation. And these weren't all youngsters. Many of them were older people. I mean, people were receiving confirmation into their 70s and 80s who'd never received it. And they thronged into the church there. And they all pressed forward towards the altar, so much so that it was turning quite dangerous. And members of the local confraternity had to actually beat them back with sticks and clubs. And actually, you know, it became a bloody mess. I mean, people were actually really injured. There was blood flowing in the chapel. And then they got confirmed. So, I mean, that was memorable.
Listening to Salvador talk about the changes as the church moved indoor and the idea of civilizing people reminded me of some of my research I had done around the Anglesey Road, and when they were built through the mountains, the British authorities believed they were civilizing those communities. So I asked Salvador, was what was happening in the church similar to this?
Yeah, I think, no, I think you would really have to link both of them. So this idea of, you know, civilizing people, this idea of instructing people on how to behave properly, this sort of thrust towards greater moral living, for instance. And of course, later on, that's tied very much into a whole Victorian attitude towards, for instance, even sexual morality. And you can't separate that from also what's going on in terms of the Catholic Church and church reform. I mean, one of the things that one of the things that happens in local parishes is people being denounced from the altars, oftentimes indiscriminately by individual priests. You could have, you know, a young couple who, you know, had a sexual relationship outside of marriage or whatever, and they're hauled into the chapel and then they have to kneel down and confess their sin in front of all the congregation. I mean, that could be done at a local level and insisted upon by a local priest. He would denounce them from the altar. And it became such an issue, it ended up creating a lot more disorder than order. So much so that I think it was the Synod of Thurles or shortly afterwards, that actually being denounced from the altar in such a way was reserved only to the bishop or those who had the bishop or the bishop's express permission to do so. So the individual priests were, if they did it without the permission of the bishop, they could be hauled over the coals for it, because it was seen as actually creating more social disorder than actually fixing anything.
I'd like to thank Salvador for his time. It was a really illuminating interview. The next episode is part two, and that's entitled The Crime. And as the name suggests, we get right into the heart of the series in that episode. That's already available at patreon.com/Irish podcast or Acast Plus for supporters. You can find links in the show notes below if you want to listen to that right now. Until next time, Sloan.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.